Good evening. Welcome to the Celeria Report. Today is September 18th, 2014. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Upcoming events, next Wednesday, I'm going to be in Albuquerque. We're having a subscriber luncheon with Catherine. If you're in the area, I hope you come. Lots to talk about. In fact, we've got some questions from some of the participants even tonight. And then I'm headed for California, and on November 8th and 9th, that weekend, in Menlo Park, we're going to be having an invitation-only event, How Do I Live a Free and Inspired Life and Help Others Do the Same, despite the big breakaway civilization pink elephant. Invitations were mailed today. If you want an invitation, please let us know. That's limited to 35 places. We want to keep it very small and intimate. And Joseph Farrell is going to be joining me live on site, and then John Rappaport coming in by Skype. And we're really looking forward to that. Our theme tonight is Cotton Candy Land. That's the name of a commentary. It's inspired by Elvis Presley's song Cotton Candy Land. And let me tell you the story of how I came to think about what I wrote and sort of what happened and what burped out. In 2006, after I settled the litigation, I published a story. It's really an online book called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. I've tried to publish it three times and three times run into so much interference. And the last time, real serious threats that I've just said, well, it's free. It's up online. I don't have to publish it in book form. It's certainly not that kind of fight. It's not as though it's suppressed in any way. One of the things it talks about is the investment by a variety of Dylan partners in financing a prison company, a startup, and the extraordinary expense that posed to taxpayers. As time goes by, you see what comes out. One of the big questions I have is Dylan was bringing money in from a variety of offshore accounts whose investors were nameless in terms of SEC or other disclosure. And I have big questions about what that money was and where it came from, including the money that were being laundered out of HUD. And I think to this day, if the truth should ever come out about who was coming in those offshore funds and how it related to who was running the drugs, there'd be some remarkable understanding and healing going on in this country. Interestingly enough, I published that in April 2006. In 2008, 2 years later, the former chairman of Dylan Reed, Nicholas Brady, who's highlighted in the story, published a private autobiography for his family and friends. You know, but you have to be careful about that stuff because, lo and behold, one of them ended up on Amazon for sale in the used section. So naturally, I bought it, and it was very interesting to read. It's the description of a whole life and history that's designed to, it's the story you tell your grandchildren. It's not the real story. And I can be highly confident because I was there for some of the real story. And I know a little bit about the story. And it kind of reminds me of some of the other autobiographies I've been reading recently. When I wrote the commentary about all of this called Candyland, I started off as follows. I've been reading the autobiographies of political and business leaders reaching the apex of their career. I've downloaded more to read, but I'm finding it slow going. Occasionally, I review them on the blog. For a recent example, see Dick Cheney's Fluffernutter. Cheney's sort of official stories, whether to his grandchildren and the American public, are ones I love to keep abreast of. Cheney being one of the key players in financing or in the Cornell corrections. He was chairman of Halliburton, and they got the big construction. So they made the big money on the deal, and it wouldn't surprise me if Cheney had money coming in from offshore to play both sides. The interesting thing about this one is after I finished it, let me just describe some of what I wrote in Candyland. I read an elegant description of a remarkable life in which gentlemen were strategic in their thinking, kept their deals, and magically the good guys made millions and ran the country by picking the right allies at Yale, on Wall Street, in the oil patch, and because times were good. Here's what's interesting. Douglas Dillon, who was Kennedy's Secretary of Treasury, was instrumental in getting Brady appointed, he and his dad were instrumental in getting Brady appointed to be chairman of Dillon Reed. And of course, Nick's rise to Secretary of the Treasury was very much fueled by his very close friendship with George H.W. Bush. And of course, there's no mention in the book of what Dillon Bush had to do with the assassination of Kennedy and what that had to do with anything, let alone Dillon Reed's financing of groups like the Nazis. So, it's, you know, it's quite a, and R.J.R. Nabisco, which was featured heavily in the Dillon Reed story I wrote, is not even mentioned, despite the fact that it was from a profit standpoint, I believe it was Dillon Reed's biggest client. Here's what was interesting. I had an epiphany when I finished the book. It was very interesting that I should have found this autobiography to be so inspiring in terms of thinking about what we're going to be doing over the next couple years here at the Solari Report. I've had more and more clients and subscribers express to me their concern that their children are going to be a disadvantage competing in this world because their children are not being taught how the world really works and how to deal with it effectively. And when I read this autobiography, I thought, you know, this is frightening because here you have somebody who's persuading his grandchildren that the world is very different than it is, and it's going to put them at a terrible disadvantage. My closing paragraph in Cotton Candy Land was, if old line WASPs want to stay on top through the generations, we're going to need to rethink our approach to education. If we don't, the sons and daughters of Russian mafia, Chinese triads, Japanese Yakuza, and Ukraine oligarchs will be running things, snatching the fortunes of our descendants as they burn through the family capital trying to do deals in Cotton Candy Land, where they naively believe grandfather made his millions and lived happily ever after. It made me wonder. I put up as a related reading our link to the interview we did with Jamie Johnson. And the last time I talked to Jamie, he was off trying to figure out how the old WASP could get revived. And I'm hoping to see what he pops out with because something has to give. But one of the things you want to think about is the absolute importance of the children and grandchildren in your family, the people you love, having the kind of real deal financial literacy they need to be successful in the world as it has become and is becoming, thanks in no small part to people like Nicholas F. Brady. Okay, money and markets. A couple really big stories that I want to focus on this week. One, of course, is that the Fed announced it was going to take considerable time because growth to taper and to adjust interest rates because growth was moderate. That Fed announcement was yesterday afternoon. They cut the taper another $5 billion a month, but they indicated interest rates are going to stay low for some time. And so we're in a world of financial repression where there's an overabundance of credit circulated to the quote-unquote right people, and financial repression has used sort of more rules and regulations to manage things. It's very much a slow burn world, slow burn triumphant. The markets responded positively with the S&P 500 and the Dow closing today at record highs. For the year now, treasuries are up approximately 11%, S&P up about 9%, emerging markets up approximately 5%. Gold rallied a little bit. It had looked weak and is now up about 2% for the year. Let's see if any of this helps affirm gold. The dollar has done well, and the bottom line is the central banks continue to put air in the global balloon. That's what it's about. And what that meant was it was a great day to be doing your IPO, let alone one of the biggest IPOs ever done. Alibaba, we'll talk about in a second, went ahead and priced today, inspired by the Fed's no bluish, no bleige. Yellen is doing well. If you look at somebody published her, did a FOIA for her diaries and published an analysis of where she's spending her time. She's spending a tremendous amount of time listening internally to staff, to the Fed presidents, the other governors, and a lot less time listening to Wall Street, and that means she's doing a very good job of building consensus. She has trouble ahead, and let me tell you a little bit about what it is and what I'm looking for. When I became Assistant Secretary of Housing, I had five deputies. I had a deputy for each one of the three line management operations I ran. And then I had two general deputies, a general deputy and an assistant general deputy. The assistant general deputy was a very capable civil service person. He'd been a political appointee and then done what's called careering in. And then there was a political appointee in the general deputy spot who was not generally as more of a staff background, not a strong line management background, who suddenly became under tremendous pressure to the secretary to basically circumvent me to get things done within the line management operation. So, for example, the secretary would call me into his office and say, you know, there's corruption in this program. I want you to shut it down. And then he'd call my general deputy in and say, I just told Fitz to shut this down, make sure she fails. And that's because he wanted to tell the New York Times that he was doing one thing when, in fact, he was doing the opposite. So you had a real non-alignment between what the law said you're supposed to do and what, you know, taxpayers think you're supposed to do versus what politics or the black budget or the White House want you to do. And so you have this, you know, it's the red button problem at the micro level. And so what you do is you have, you know, you make a prominent woman the head and you have her run around and say, we're really trying hard to fix this. And then you make sure that the lawyers or the general deputies, it's really in the general deputy or the general counsel line, engineer what's good for the black budget, et cetera. What happened was the general deputy was not particularly savvy or not very knowledgeable and very good at running the line management. And what started to happen was the three deputies who were running the line would come back to me and say, you know, the general deputy's just been here and said this. And what he's saying makes absolutely no sense. Part of the problem was the secretary and his group were also completely incompetent to sort of run any kind of complex operation. And, you know, they were used to being in Congress and saying stuff and having no accountability or responsibility for real operations underneath them. It was very much, you know, kind of fruit flies trying to run a highly complex financial institution. Anyway, so the line management deputies would come to me and say, okay, you know, he said this, what should we do? And it got to the point where we would have our deputy meeting once a week. We'd talk about what the general deputy had told everybody to do, and then we'd figure out what we could do. We didn't want to, you know, we wanted to do what the secretary wanted. At the same time, we didn't want to break the law. So it got to be very complex and confusing, but we kind of muddled our way through. Well, finally, the secretary got hip to the fact that the general deputy wasn't going to be able to really get anything done in the machinery of the operations, and that I remained in complete control. And so finally, out of disgust, he encouraged the general deputy to move on. He was hoping to bring in someone else who would be more forceful. So what happened was he got recommended to be the first executive director of the Resolution Trust Corporation. And oddly enough, Nick Brady, being the Secretary of the Treasury, one of Nick's staff called me and said, you know, should we make this guy, you know, is this guy okay to be the executive director? And I said, well, he's basically a staff guy, not a line guy, so he'd be much better over there than here. He had come to me and said, please, would you put in a good recommendation and not kill me. I've gotten caught between you and Jack. It's really not my fault. Help me out. So I'm basically a generous person. I did, which turned out to be a mistake. But at the swearing in, one of the counsel from HUD was over for the swearing in, and the secretary was there. And this guy gets sworn in to be executive director of the RTC. And as they're waiting for the swearing in to occur, it's over at Treasury. I think it was in the cash room. The secretary turns to the general deputy and says, you know what your problem is, Peter? You can't even take out a woman. Well, lo and behold, no good deed goes unpunished. This guy got over to Treasury, proceeded to do a favor for Jack and try and blame everything on me. And it took years for the truth to come out. But, you know, it taught me to be careful in situations like this. So let's turn back to Yellen. What's Yellen's challenge? Well, a bunch of private bankers who couldn't possibly get their guy in the number one spot, given all the corruption, managed to put Stanley Fisher in as the number two vice chairman. Now, who is Stanley Fisher? First of all, Stanley Fisher is an Israeli citizen who's been served as the vice chair of the U.S. served as the chair of the Bank of Israel from 2005 to 2013. So you can imagine if they tried to put him in the number one spot, what the, you know, what the hoopla could have been in a wide variety of parties, let alone all the conspiracy theorists about the Fed. But it would have given a lot of energy, I can assure you, Ron Paul and his fundraising. So the chances of putting Stanley Fisher in the number one spot were very small. But if they put Yellen in the number one spot and then try and set things up so that Fisher can really run things behind her back and just make her a face, that's a way to sort of have their cake and eat it too. So I make a prediction you're going to see the private bankers trying to engineer things through the number two spot. My prediction is it's not going to work. But in a stressful period, we're going to see Yellen has a lot of her hands full. And it's going to be interesting to watch the state of play. As I said, with the Fed making their announcement on Wednesday, it was a great day to do the IPO today. Alibaba came out at an offering price at 68 at the top of their expected range. They raised $21.8 billion. Unless they exercise a green shoe, I don't know if there was a green shoe in it, but unless they exercise it, that won't make them the number one largest IPO to date. I think it's going to put them third behind the Agricultural Bank of China and ICBC's flotation. But clearly one of the biggest ever. What was interesting is the response of some of the investors. There's more than a few reports of at least 30 to 40 large institutional orders of $1 billion or more. So very big institutional response. Let's see how they do in the aftermarket. So next week will be interesting to see how the stock trades in the secondary market. But I think the Alibaba, a lot of what you're seeing is happening at the same time. And I wanted to point two stories which I believe are very much connected. We saw last week and this week, China has announced that they're going to allow foreign investors to buy A shares on the Chinese exchange. And then they announced they're going to allow foreign investors to buy gold in their new gold exchange. Now, that is very, very big. It was said very, very quietly, nowhere near the hoopla of the Alibaba offering. But I believe that those were, if you look at the Alibaba offering and those two decisions, they are both part of a major deal in a global rebalancing between China and the United States. There's no way that the United States is going to let Alibaba come into our markets and walk off with $22 billion without getting a deal. And my guess is that if you look at the strength of the U.S. dollar, that's a part of this deal. The Chinese have a big pile of dollars that they want to go spend around the world. And the United States can just print dollars and use it to buy stuff around the world. So if you look at what that rise of the dollar has done in terms of going out and buying another more than $22 billion worth of stuff, it's certainly done that. And so I think the Chinese and the Americans have done a handshake deal. And these different decisions are part of them. The thing that's so fascinating about that, these events and that kind of deal, is that's a very big step in the securitization of global equity by China opening its markets to sort of foreign and liquid investment. And we're going to see more Chinese buying foreign investment. We've certainly seen it in real estate in California these days. We're watching the securitization of global equity moving to an unprecedented period. I said to somebody today that I plan to manage money for the next 20 years, because if you look at the shift of a huge percentage of the global equity into the securitized markets, this is the first time and only time this is going to happen on the planet. It's an unprecedented event, and I almost feel like I've trained my whole life for what's happening, and as I said to somebody this morning, I wouldn't miss it for the world. as I said, this was the whole process was a little or was supportive of gold, but I think the low gold price has been part of whatever the U.S. and China are engineering for the global shopping spree, including China buying more gold with dollars that are worth a lot. Anyway, so big day for Alibaba, and needless to say, Jack Ma's hit it right every year since 1999, and he did it again this year. If you haven't watched the interview I posted of Jack Ma with Charlie Rose, I really recommend it. Very important cultural shift that is coming through Alibaba and what they're up to. As I said, this Scottish referendum is we're waiting to hear today. We should know late tonight. I'll probably know about midnight tonight here in Tennessee. There are 4.7 million people registered to vote in the referendum. It's one man, one vote. And when you look at the numbers, it's a little bit larger than Tennessee, and kind of makes you realize that it's a small country with a lot of impact. My guess is whatever happens, it won't have a big impact on the financial system, despite all the hoopla. And it'll be very interesting to see if the Scottish choose decentralization or not. It's all part of the decentralization that's going to be occurring, and balkanization, which is not necessarily against the interests of the guys who walked out of the financial coup d'etat with all the money. It's all part of sovereign governments getting less powerful and private money getting more powerful. I put up a little commentary on the latest Gallup poll. It came in, and it's not good news for incumbents running in the midterm elections. One in four Americans, 23%, are satisfied with how things are going. 76% are dissatisfied. One of the reasons that poll is so important is that 80% is the magic number. When you get 80% dissatisfaction or greater, you've got a supermajority, and that's when unexpected things start to happen. And I'm going to make a prediction. I talked in the wrap-up, and I'm going to keep talking about this shift from global 2.0 to 3.0. We're seeing so many organizations that don't see it coming. They've seen the current system hold the line, and they don't realize suddenly how things, how literally the market can shift on them. And a perfect example is the latest comments from the NFL. There's a little bit of a brouhaha at the NFL because players who are caught doing domestic violence towards spouses or kids people are complaining to the NFL. They want them to take action and are dissatisfied with the sufficiency of the actions that the NFL is taking. And unfortunately, today we even had Nancy Pelosi jump in and start commenting on it. Interestingly enough, there was an article this week in the Wall Street Journal, Anheuser-Busch pressuring the NFL to be more assertive and aggressive on this issue. And NFL made a comment basically, you know, we have lots of sponsors and, you know, there's a long waiting list of sponsors. And basically not understanding that Anheuser-Busch wasn't speaking so much for the shareholders. They've got a big market, and when you're coming into these levels of dissatisfaction, you have to be very, very careful. This is all part of a no-privacy world where there's a lot more transparency, and if everybody's got a camera on their cell phone, there's going to be far tighter reverberation and feedback. And it's clear to me that the NFL doesn't understand the way the game is shifting. But they're far from alone. There's going to be a lot of people with that problem. War games. If I said the S&P is up 8% for the year, Lockheed Martin, the number one defense contractor, number one government contractor, is up over 20%. And that's surprising, not surprising given what we're seeing ongoing around the globe. The U.S. has announced that it is invading Africa. Of course, we've had a whole African force on the ground, but now the Ebola pandemic is being, well, the Ebola outbreak in Western Africa is being mediafied into a pandemic, and now Obama is announcing the military is invading Africa to help with the pandemic. this very much fits in with my earlier prediction that I thought Ebola was going to be about African investment. But sending more military over there means that they're just going to get that much more aggressive. And part of this is a competition with China for a lot of the resources in Africa, as well as getting that market share running through your stocks. Although given what we're watching with gold and Alibaba and the opening of Chinese markets, it wouldn't surprise me if this is part of the U.S. deal with China. They've decided to sort of slice up Africa between the two of them. I put up a translation of a French article up on the blog about it. It was not really highlighted in the U.S. press. We also see Secretary of Defense Hagel and the Joint Chiefs up on the congressional testimony talking about are really running a trial balloon for boots on the ground in Iraq, and the extent to which the Islamic State or ISIS wag the dog show has gotten this week and over the last month is frightening in the extreme. This goes to the level of serious Nazi-style grand lies. And you almost wonder about the programming, as the polls have certainly gone from no support for military intervention in the Middle East to much higher support. And you almost wonder if people aren't just assuming that if they don't go along, it's instead of getting absurd lies thrown in their face, they're going to get something worse. And so it's kind of a marketing by terrifying. Russia, we continue to see a complete commitment by the G7 to balkanize Russia, and Russia is clearly digging in for the long haul. They're putting together a reserve fund to deal with sanctions, a very smart thing to do. Interestingly enough, we see someone post a $30 million reward for information about MH17. It's so clever what's going on, because you've seen the different powers involved try and sort of coordinate on the Malaysian 370 fight. They had a real flight. They had a real problem because countries could never agree with each other's headlines. Instead, with Malaysian 17, we see the different countries involved sign a pact that nobody's going to come out with anything unless everybody comes out with it. So they're learning, but whoever is posting 30 million rewards is learning too. So that's going to be very interesting to see what it does. We're also seeing reports from the Ukraine about what it's like to live with lower and lower supplies of gas. The winter's coming to Ukraine, and so the pressure on the Ukraine to play ball with Russia is going to rise throughout what is probably going to be a very cold winter. Last but not least, I put a very interesting video up on the blog under the wildcard section. One of the things I'll occasionally do is dip into the different descriptions of what the more bizarre things going on in geopolitics may have to do with the politics of aliens. You know, and I never know quite what to think of them, but there's a new guy on the scene. He's a politician who is a very successful local politician, Labour Party politician in England, Simon Parks. I've watched a number of interviews. He's a very capable guy, very capable about local government, very, very capable about politics. And he claims to have had multiple interactions with aliens since a very young age. And he's got some interesting descriptions of things. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I find him to be very capable and very competent, certainly is to talk when he talks about the financial system and the political system. So if you're interested in some of the exopolitic descriptions of what's going on in this world, there it is, Simon Parks. Our hero this week is Occupy Wall Street, which has now abolished $4 million in other people's student loan debt. Very cleverly, not only have they done a good job of raising money, but they've done a good job of running around and buying up the debt at a discount, so they're able to extinguish $4 million of debt with a lot less than $4 million. So they did the right thing, and they did it at the right price. So big kudos to Occupy Wall Street. Ask Catherine. Please check out Paul Craig Roberts' comments on the Fed's no longer allowing banks to hold municipal bonds as collateral ranked lower now than corporate bonds. He states this could herald a new phase of the harvesting privatizing of American city assets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The interview's up on King World News. I don't watch King World News. So I don't listen to King World News, and I have no intention of doing so. And I strongly recommend you stay away from it as well. I do think it's an ominous sign. I also think that the municipalities have the power to get that reversed, at least this time. So we'll see what happens, because particularly in election year, the lobbying is going to be heavy on this. I don't think it's going to kill the market for municipal bonds whatsoever, but it's all part of the tremendous discrepancy in cost of capital. You know, we have a world where people who become billionaires got there because they were paying 1% or less and getting inside information, and other people were getting no information, being lied to, and paying 30% interest rates. And it doesn't take a genius to realize, you know, that if you can borrow money at 0% with inside information, you know, you're eventually going to end up as a billionaire. So it's quite clever the way you make the system look like it's a market, but then you rig cost of capital to really to manage it in the kind of slow burn economy that we have. Hello, Catherine. Do you know about this company that has this gold and silver IRA? Not that it is a good time to buy. Here's the link. I don't know that company. I'll take a look. This is from somebody who's going to be in Albuquerque next week. If you like, at lunch, we can go through all the different steps of buying and holding non-liquid and gold, including gold and silver, non-liquid assets, including gold and silver in an IRA. I'd be delighted to do that when I'm there. Catherine, you frequently address issues important for investors. What do you see as the highest priorities for tiny investors, 50,000 or less, who are trying to preserve and increase their capital in this corrupt and rigged environment? I love the Solari report. I have an old audio, it's a bit dated, called Solari Portfolio Strategy. It's one of the audio seminars available to you at the Resource Center. That might help you, as well as the Building Financial Wealth package we put together. But I'll absolutely think about doing this, possibly as part of the series we're doing with the Team Awesome Solari Circle. And so that's a great suggestion for a Solari report, and I'll think about that. We'll definitely get that on the schedule. I did want to note that I'm working on one for first-time home buyers. So we've got a lot of young people looking to buy homes, and I want to make sure we have something for them that helps them understand sort of what the issues are and what the mistakes that, you know, most often get made, and how to avoid them, how to have a successful experience buying a home and making sure it's a great investment. Okay, let's go to the movies. I've been waiting years to post this one. Our documentary this week is A Long Way Around. It's 5.5 hours. It was a series of, I think, 10 shows that Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman did on their motorcycle ride from London through all across Asia, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, Siberia, Russia, and then down over to Alaska and down through Canada, Alaska and Canada, down to New York. It was in 2010, we had an intern who persuaded me to watch it, and I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to hate this. This is going to be totally boring. And I put it on. He made me promise. And so one Saturday morning, I put it on thinking, you know, I'll watch 15 minutes and find it unbearable. I ended up watching it. You know, it was 2 p.m. by the time I finished. I love motorcycles. When I lived in Hong Kong, I had a motorcycle on either side of the, you know, one on the island and one on the mainland. And that was the day before the tunnels. And so you had to ride the ferry back and forth. And I also rode a bicycle across the United States. So the idea of tripping around the world on motorcycles is a gas. And if you don't have, you know, the wherewithal or the time to do it, tag along with Charlie Borman and Ewan McGregor. It really is an inspiring and extraordinary adventure, and it infused me with a lot of new energy for living the inspired and free life. Okay, our interview this week, before, as we mailed the invitations, which we did to the subscribers who've expressed interest and the people who are in the subscribers who are in the general area, I wanted to get John Rappaport and Joseph Farrell on the phone. We came out of San Mateo together wanting to continue the conversation. A lot of the subscribers who attended said, how do I break away? How do I break away? How can I be happy in a world like this? And of course, how do I make sure my children understand what's really going on and can be successful as well? So John and Joseph and I kept talking, and we decided we would put together an event that was both a backcasting, and a backcasting being the opposite of forecasting, where you create a vision in the future and then work back how you accomplished it. And so the wonderful Ben Lazzardi, who's a wonderful member of our team, whose firm Lazzardi Communications helps us with our graphics and marketing, said, well, you know, if we're going to be in integrity, then we in the Solari team have to do it ourselves. And so he flew to Tennessee, and some of our team members flew in from other states, and we all met here in Hickory Valley and had a couple day strategic planning. And it was kind of tough for me, because I kept thinking, I said to somebody, I'm having trouble coming up with a really inspired vision, because without an inspired vision of how I'm going to get around the obstacles, then an inspired vision is just like more work. It was interesting, but we had very great inspiration on the obstacles, and I came out of it feeling very, very excited about where we're going at Solari. And then many, many hours with Joseph and John on the phone. And so I decided I wanted to share some of those background conversations with you. Dr. Farrell brings extraordinary scholarship to this endeavor. And one of the things I asked him to do were providing audios and videos beforehand on the event. One of the ones I asked him to provide was to give us a breakdown of some of the most successful conspiracies in history and how they organized and what made them effective and successful. And he did. It's quite intriguing. And then, of course, John, for his presentation, is going into how our world is engineered by others and how we can use those skills and tactics to do so ourselves. We're very focused on tactics and strategies. I, as I always end the Solari Report, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. But one of the things I'm learning about us, many, many people in the developed worlds, is we really don't know how to go about engaging in conspiracies, and we're going to have to learn. So check out that interview, and if you're interested in joining us, as I said, there are only 35 slots, but we're going to keep a waiting list, and if there's more interest, we hope to take it on the road into the heartland of the country. And if there's more interest, we'll take it to Europe or Asia. We're happy to go on the road. So that's it in closing. I'm leaving Hickory Valley, headed for Albuquerque. If you're in that area, I hope to see you at lunch next week. And then from somewhere in the Southwest, I'll be talking with you on September 25th on Managing End of Life with Jo Klein Sebahar. I just love her. She's a great attorney who was chair of the biggest hospice in Iowa and knows a lot about how you handle the passage of family and friends and yourself. And it's make friends with death. It's a great thing to do. I've certainly done it. And it's a skill set that just gives you a lot of power in life. October 2nd, third quarter wrap up. I've gotten a lot more requests to unpack investment strategy for 2.0 to 3.0. So Chuck Gibson and I are doing that in our equity overview on November 18th. In anticipation of that, I want to dive in and lay out the 12 big trends that we'll be addressing. So we'll do a trend analysis. What are the top 12 trends that define from 2.0 to 3.0? Then October 9th, in response to many, many requests, we'll be doing Spiritual Warfare with Franklin Sanders. Many of you have asked me about spiritual warfare, and so this will be an interesting one. I talked to Franklin about it this week and got him to promise it was fine if we just disagreed, because we disagree on lots of things. Well, we agree on all the most important ones on spiritual matters, but we are known to disagree, so we're going to have a really lively conversation. And, of course, talk about very much our own personal experiences of using spiritual warfare tools to navigate the environment and deal with the obstacles. So until September 25th, speaking from somewhere in the Southwest, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.